The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says Lieutenant General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. 2 years ago, is the symbol of hope and perseverance in the region. A leading food industry body warns about food shortages in the U.K. as new post-Brexit custom rules take effect. And many countries around the globe welcome the new year with celebrations overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic for the second year. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader says Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in 2020, has turned into a role model for the younger generation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the martyrdom of the top general as a national and international event. The leader said the nationwide commemoration of the martyrdom of General Soleimani shows that the Iranian people are appreciative of the services and efforts by this great martyr. Ayatollah Khamenei said Soleimani's school of thought was marked by sincerity and devotion. He said that the martyrdom of Soleimani has made the regional resistance movement more hopeful. The leader made these comments in a meeting with Soleimani's family, as well as members of a commission set up to honor him. The leader of Iran's revolution has said that resistance movements in the region are more hopeful today due to the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani. Now, Tehran is hosting a ceremony that is marking the first anniversary of the passing of a top Iranian religious figure, Ayatollah Mohammad Taghi Mesbah Yazdi. The ceremony wrapped up just hours ago. American philosopher Professor Mohammad Ilkhsan was in attendance. He described Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi as a true philosopher with deep insights and great wisdom. He also said the late Ayatollah showed great interest in philosophical discussions and was open to differences of opinion on various topics. Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi served in various positions during his lifetime and was involved in numerous research, cultural, educational, and political activities. He was a member of Iran's Assembly of Experts and passed away at the age of 85. Moving on, Iran says making scientific advancements, especially in the field of aerospace, is its inalienable right. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh, says meddlesome statements will not affect Iran's will for progress in aerospace. Khatibzadeh was referring to comments by American, French, and German officials on Iran's recent space launch. He rejected their claims that the move violated United Nations Security Council resolutions. The spokesman said Tehran reserves the right to expand its scientific know-how and will not wait for the approval of other countries. Also on Thursday, Iran said that it launched a domestically made satellite carrier with research payloads into space. Political commentator Masoud Shajari says the U.S. seeks to keep countries like Iran away from developing new technologies.
You really need to see what the U.S. policy as a colonial power is. It actually wants to keep everyone within the Middle East and beyond away from technology, keep them back in the Stone Ages. And as long as they're concerned, they don't want any development, any knowledge, any improvement of science, technology, or anything else within places like Iran. So, they're going to, every time there is an achievement, and indeed this is a great achievement for Iranian satellite project, they are going to start moaning, they're going to start sort of associating it with the nuclear technology, etc., etc. This is expected. And the reality is that even, you know, by that definition, they should be sort of opposing to Iran to have universities or even schools. Because out of that, it could come technology, and it will come technology. Iran has been forefront of technology in a very vast area, despite all the sanction. And this is great achievement without the sanction. But with the sanction, this is actually almost a miracle.
And at least one Yemeni has been killed in the Saudi-led coalition's latest attack on the country's northern Saada province. Local media say the Saudi artillery attack has also injured three others in the Arakuj region. Saudi Arabia has stepped up its attacks on Yemen in recent weeks, targeting several cities across the country. Last month, the attacks left several civilians dead. Yemen has been devastated by the Saudi-led war from more than 6 years now. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine. UN says the war has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And at least three members of a Saudi death squad that murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi on October 2019 are not spending their time in jail, but in luxury villas in Riyadh. That has been revealed by a leading British daily, The Guardian, citing a Saudi intelligence source. Three assailants are said to be living in seven-star accommodation inside government-run security compound. Two witnesses visiting the facility several times in the past 2 years have told the source that they have seen three men. The same source says that the men include Salah al-Tukai. He is the forensic scientist who dismembered Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Al-Tukai and the two other men have already been convicted on Khashoggi's killing before a Saudi court. The trial, however, was widely criticized as a sham, and now the latest report casts doubt further about on the Saudi claims that justice has been served. U.S. intelligence agencies have said Khashoggi was murdered by the order of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salah. And a writer and a political analyst, John White, believes that the latest revelations regarding Khashoggi's murder should not come as a surprise to anybody.
This is absolutely no surprise. This was murder most foul against the Saudi dissident journalist, who was also a US resident, which you would think of, would have afforded him some protection. And the cover-up that followed was with the compliance of Western governments, who offered only the most tepid criticisms and sanctions against bin Salman for the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. And so what we have is an indictment of Western foreign policy in terms of the relationship with the Saudis, which is less, Saudi Arabia is less a state and more a family business, whose business is murder. So these revelations come as absolutely no surprise. The men who were involved in this murder are very close to bin Salman, part of his inner coterie of thugs and cutthroats, and indeed they're being rewarded for services to Mr. bin Salman. The man's a cutthroat, it cannot be stressed enough, and this is less a country underpinned by laws and more a family business underpinned by the rule of the knife.
Moving on, new customs rules take effect on Saturday for goods entering the UK from the European Union, but concerns have already been raised over possible food shortages caused by the new rules that are part of post-Brexit trade regulations. The new rules require UK importers to make a full customs declaration on goods arriving in their country. They're no longer allowed to delay the process for up to 175 days. The importers should also complete the correct paperwork at least 4 hours before the arrival of the goods. Animal and plant-based products need statements of origin certificates too. Now, a leading British food industry body says it is worried that the new border controls could lead to food shortages, and that is because, it says, not everyone in the supply chain might be ready for these controls. The company expects January to be a fraught month for its members. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is set to receive a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth, but many Britons believe that the Premier should be in prison for his role in the Iraq War instead of getting the title. Anti-war activists are accusing Blair of war crimes during the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Outraged by the royal court's decision, they are demanding Blair's trial at an international tribune. Georgia Aylett, and an environmentalist, says that it is a joke to put a war criminal on the New Year's honors list. Former lawmaker George Galloway calls Blair a mass murderer, liar, and charlatan who is now taking, quote, the biscuit. And GB News presenter Tonya Buxton says that she is sickened to see the knighthood of a man who caused the deaths of so many people. And the COVID pandemic is plummeting Europe hard, with new Omicron variant being blamed for the rapid surge. France has reported its all-time record of over 232,000 daily infections. This is the third straight day that the country logs over 2,000 cases, 200,000, that is, cases. Ramin Mazahiri has more from Paris.
France has broken the European record for corona infections, and nations across Western Europe are also reaching new daily highs as the pandemic has entered a new but seemingly less deadly phase.
The coronavirus right now is exploding right now in France. It's very scary to see. I saw over 200,000 infections in France in one day. So I'm nervous. I'm trying to get back to the United States right now, and I'm waiting for a COVID test right now. I'm very nervous. I want to make sure that it's negative so I'm able to get back home.
France currently has over 4 million active cases of corona, but 99.9% of them are classified as mild. Daily deaths are half of what they were a year ago, while shorter quarantines are being approved. Cases are soaring in part because many more people are getting tested prior to holiday gatherings, but France's hospital admissions are just a third of previous peaks. It appears increasingly certain that the new Omicron variant may spread like wildfire, but that it is significantly less lethal, causing many to have a cautious sense of relief.
Corona is mainly just a bad flu. It's only a serious risk for certain types of people. But for the overwhelming majority of people, if you get vaccinated, if you quarantine when you have symptoms, if you use common sense to protect yourself and others, then all will be fine.
The high transmission rate of Omicron does have some taking scientifically questionable steps not seen since the early days of the pandemic. Paris has just made face masks mandatory in all public places, even outdoors. Some nations, which aren't seeing an increase in cases, have banned public holiday festivities anyway. France, Italy, and other countries are debating making their health passes even more restrictive, which many say is an abuse of personal freedom.
France has long been considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but measures which amount to either get vaccinated or live in social isolation have coerced 80% of the country into getting vaccinated.
One fact appears vital.
In France, the unvaccinated are far more likely to be in intensive care than those who have chosen to be inoculated. What many are hoping for in 2022 is that Omicron truly does herald the end of the lethal phase of Corona 19, which would render moot the controversies and uncertainties over how to best handle the long-running pandemic. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And the world welcomes the new year with scaled-back celebrations due to restrictions aimed at battling the rising COVID infections led by Omicron. Americans gathered in New York's Times Square to watch the famous ball drop event, but it was scaled down to only 15,000 spectators. Brazil celebrated 2022 with fireworks while official events were canceled. The situation was the same for most of Europe, including Greece and Spain, but France even canceled its fireworks in Paris amid Omicron concerns. Those same concerns made Russia close down Moscow's iconic Red Square to the public and limit the celebrations of fireworks. 2022 marks the second straight year that COVID overshadows the New Year celebrations. Meanwhile, Australia begins 2022 with a record number of new COVID infections as an outbreak centered in the eastern states continues to grow. The country set a national record of over 33,000 daily new cases on Saturday in New South Wales. The state logged nearly 22,600 infections, which was a record. Victoria State set a record too, with almost 7,500 new daily infections. Both eastern states have seen their COVID cases and related hospitalizations grow over the week since Christmas Day. That followed the easing of restrictions and happened despite higher vaccination levels in Australia. Meanwhile, a stampede at a famous Hindu shrine in Indian-controlled Kashmir has left dozens of people dead and 20 others injured. The incident happened in the early hours of Saturday as people gathered for New Year prayers. A senior police official says an argument had broken out, making people pushing each other. Authorities say the situation is under control now. Top leaders from Indian opposition and ruling parties, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, have extended their condolences, and revered families. Modi has also announced $16,000 ex gratia to the next of kin of those who lost their lives. Now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Recently, the Commonwealth of Independent States commemorated 30 years of its existence in St. Petersburg, Russia, and highlighted a united front against NATO's eastward strides. We're prepared for you an article written by Dr. Swaram Singh, Professor of Diplomacy and Disarmament at the School of International Studies, Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India. The piece is titled, At the Commonwealth of Independent States, Putin Champions Solidarity Amid Ukraine Crisis. Tuesday, 28th of December, the Commonwealth of Independent States commemorated 30 years of its existence. In December of 1991, this informal arrangement among the majority of former Soviet republics declared the end of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, also ending the Cold War in international politics. And now, in the midst of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and the Russo-Ukrainian crisis, this informal summit in St. Petersburg, attended in person by all 9 national leaders, has radiated goals and implications way beyond their limited to-do list. Fundamentally, the summit showcased former Soviet Republic's solidarity with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who faces a purportedly united West seeking Ukraine's co-option into NATO's further eastward strides. However, Ukraine was not even mentioned in this year-end get-together of CIS leaders, who reviewed the results of Belarus's chairmanship of the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, in 2021, and discussed future plans of their cooperation. Commemorating these past 30 years, President Vladimir Putin credited the Commonwealth of Independent States members for having preserved their deeper security and economic cooperation, and for helping them getting through these difficult times of the pandemic. Putin said, "We have witnessed monumental shifts over the past years. At the same time, we have been deepening our integration, lingering positive impact from the ties we have been sharing since the Soviet era." Focusing on the agenda at hand, Vladimir Putin said, "One of the main topics that brought us together is our common efforts to counter the coronavirus pandemic," whereupon he called on his special invitee, Russia's chief sanitary physician, Anna Popova, who has been coordinating Russia's response to COVID-19 with its Commonwealth of Independent States counterparts, to brief the leaders on work done so far as well as plans for the future, including signing of an agreement on cooperation in response to and relief from sanitary and epidemiological emergencies. No doubt this allowed Russia to showcase its leading role in providing pandemic relief to the CIS states. But President Putin's hosting it in person, and the several bilateral meetings he held also carried a message for all, including American interlocutors for the upcoming meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, on 10th of January, where Moscow wishes to push forward on ways to halt the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's eastward expansion and end its military cooperation with countries such as Ukraine and Georgia. It was in 1922 that the treaty and declaration of the creation of the USSR was first signed by Russia, Belarus and Ukraine. Fast forward to 8th of December 1991, and the same 3 countries signed the agreement establishing the Commonwealth of Independent States, thus replacing the USSR and inviting other Soviet republics to join. 8 other republics joined them at their next meeting in Alma-Ata, now Almaty, in Kazakhstan, on 21st of December 1991, when they all signed a protocol declaring Russia as a successor state of the USSR, and marking this as the foundation day of the Commonwealth of Independent States, or CIS. Georgia joined the CIS later in 2004, but after it joined NATO, which led to tensions with Moscow and the Russo-Georgian War, it withdrew from the Commonwealth of Independent States in 2009. Likewise, the 3 Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, which considered their integration into Soviet Union an illegal occupation, never joined the Commonwealth of Independent States. They instead joined NATO. Likewise, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia, formerly part of the Eastern Bloc, though not actual Soviet republics, also joined NATO, igniting serious insecurities in Moscow. Ukraine, the second most powerful state of the USSR, had always been the most curious and yet confusing part of the Commonwealth of Independent States story. Ukraine signed the first two agreements and protocols of December of 1991, but never ratified the January 1993 Charter of the Commonwealth of Independent States. Nevertheless, Ukraine was treated as a founding member of the CIS until Article 7 of that charter, which defined the signatories of those first two meetings at the Commonwealth's founding members. Moreover, in 1994, Ukraine joined the Commonwealth of Independent States Economic Union as an associate member. So Russia always insisted that Ukraine was a member of the Commonwealth of Independent States, and therefore the CIS Secretariat continued to send it invitations for all the meetings. But for its part, Ukraine had a very different understanding on the role and remit of the Commonwealth of Independent States, and rarely participated in Commonwealth of Independent States parleys and programs. Indeed, on 18th of May 2013, then-President Petro Poroshenko signed a decree on Ukraine's official termination of its participation in the CIS. From 2014 onwards, Ukraine gradually distanced itself from the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, exiting various statutory bodies, not paying its contributions to the budget, and over time abandoning more than 50 agreements, memoranda, and decisions. Finally, in August of 2018, it not only stopped participating in CIS activities, but shut down its representative offices at the Commonwealth of Independent States headquarters in Minsk, Belarus. In the post-Soviet context, other than their contestations about the sharing of the Soviet debts and assets, status of the Russian language in Ukraine, ownership of the Soviet-era Black Sea Fleet and its Sevastopol naval base, and the related question of Crimea, Ukraine and Russia had serious differences on the role and functioning of the Commonwealth of Independent States. This briefly created serious misunderstandings among several Commonwealth of Independent States members, impacting its work and stature. Against this backdrop, in 1997, Russia signed a Treaty of Friendship, Cooperation and Partnership with Ukraine, recognizing its borders. But the current phase of their conflict is often connected to the NATO's indulgences with Ukraine and reignited their differences. Their conflict was to become public during the presidential elections of 2004, when the so-called Orange Revolution prevented Viktor Yanukovych from coming to power and pro-West Viktor Yushchenko became the president of Ukraine. Also in 2008, US President at the time George W. Bush pushed for inclusion of Ukraine into NATO. European nations managed to forestall his plan with no timelines finalized, but it triggered a process of NATO's penetration into Ukraine, emboldening Kiev to withstand Vladimir Putin's strategies, where he was seen as contemplating a reunification of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. Internally as well, these interfering US policies triggered countrywide unrest in Ukraine, leading to Viktor Yanukovych's fleeing to Russia in February of 2014. In a referendum by the people of Crimea in March of 2014, this region merged with Russia. This encouraged Russian-speaking minorities in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to rise against the government in Kiev and declare the creation of new people's republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. These crises were resolved in the Minsk Agreement of March 2015, which stands at the very center of their escalating brinkmanship. Under that pact, Ukraine agreed to consider these quasi-republics' demand for autonomy. However, the nationalist forces at home and NATO's allurements from the West saw Kiev retreating from implementing the agreement, and an impasse has remained since the December 2019 Russia-Ukraine talks in Paris, France. This period has also seen President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine incrementally rebuilding partnerships with NATO, leading to Russia's current heavy forward deployments. This is where it comes pertinent to understand the role of the Russia-led Commonwealth of nine former Soviet republics. President Putin is fully aware of the cautious approach of several European NATO member states that will be dependent on Russian gas to revive their post-pandemic economies. This explains why Vladimir Putin wants to expand the dialogue beyond US President Joe Biden's domestically driven arbitration on the Ukraine crisis. Vladimir Putin's recent summits with India and China also show that there are other potential customers for Russia's energy supplies. Indeed, Ukraine itself wants to negotiate with Russia for extension of latter's gas transit beyond 31st of December 2024, when the current agreement expires. Yet Russia remains reluctant, saying it will depend on its own supply contracts and on target recipients' whims and fancies. So, have Vladimir Putin's summits with India, China, and now the Commonwealth of Independent States revealed the boomerang effect of a united West posturing a tough line? And is it possible that Ukraine, having burnt its bridges with Russia, regrets its own absence from recent Commonwealth of Independent States summit?
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Palestinian journalists have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on Facebook, a claim backed by rights groups. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, has rejected the claim, saying its policies were designed to give everyone a voice, but Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have been simmering for years, and were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said the platform had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights violations by Israel. According to a Palestinian social media monitoring center, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021 alone. Joining us now from Ramallah is our correspondent, Mona Candy. Mona, how alarming are these findings?
Well, recently it was very clear that journalists and social media activists when posting anything on Facebook, clearly mentioning the word, let's say, for example, martyr or martyrdom, or even Israeli crimes, massacres, that immediately Facebook would remove or delete such posts. Facebook has been removing these posts, claiming they violated the platform's standards. But Palestinians, as you have mentioned, see these claims as a pro-Israeli bias at Facebook, because when it comes to mentioning the Israeli crimes, when it comes to mentioning some issues in the occupied territories, then they would be seen as violating the platform Facebook standards. Palestinians today are saying that Facebook is simply having double standards, is simply backing the Israeli narration. Why it's only the Palestinians who are suffering from these, from especially this treatment. Multiple incidents happened, and they are seen as censorship. According to Palestinian social media monitoring center, Sada Social said that at least 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were deleted or restricted. We can say that every day a number of Palestinians are being restricted to post anything. It's considered as a punishment just for addressing the Israeli crimes and just for posting some Israeli shootings that are carried out against Palestinians, or even if they write the word martyr in Arabic or martyrdom as well.
All right, thanks a lot, Tamar Kanda, joining us from Ramallah. Let's now take a look at the tail of the tape of our guest for Spotlight. Founding director of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies from San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdullah, joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Rabab Abdul Hadi joining us from San Francisco. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have simmered for years. Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Is Facebook suppressing freedom of speech?
Yes, definitely there is a lot of evidence of that. The most recent attack has been the big campaign that Palestinian social media bloggers posted, which entitled Facebook Censors Jerusalem. And it was basically where Facebook basically blocked every single post in which Palestinians will, as your reporter said, mention the word martyr, shaheed, prisoner, Jerusalem. They shut down the two big networks in Jerusalem. They shut down accounts for multiple Palestinians and so on. Facebook claimed that this was about their algorithm. But the question is that the algorithm is designed by people. So who plays these words to make them blocked by algorithm? But I think there is a bigger picture too, that Facebook has historically and continuously continued to block Palestinian content. I can just mention maybe a couple of examples historically by Facebook actually going and making a deal with the Israeli government, Facebook collaborating with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which task is to actually block and silence Palestinian voices and Palestinian advocacy voices for Palestinian liberation around the world. Facebook also, Zuckerberg met with the Israelis multiple times. They hired as one of the major media people in Facebook a former officer of the Israeli government who is known to be anti-Palestinian. I know from our own experience at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies program that Facebook has been targeted by several pro-Zionist groups that have tried to shut us down, starting in 2013 with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is in Los Angeles, which has been built, the so-called Museum of Tolerance, on the land of the Palestinian cemetery, Ma'manillah, Mamila, in Jerusalem. It was followed by my provost, my own academic provost, demanding that I take down a post in which I criticize my university president for welcoming Zionists to campus, which is supposed to be my own academic freedom. And the post that I posted was actually, I shared the post from one of our student groups, Jews Against Zionism, who said that they are opposed to welcoming Zionism on campus because of its colonialism, its racism, its apartheid. And it had a picture of a young student who was saying, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm anti-Zionist, I'm not anti-Semitic, free Palestine. And so they thought that this was actually a violation. The university provost demanded that I take it down. The dean demanded that I take it down. And I said, no, I'm not going to be doing it. This is my academic freedom. As was condemned by the university president and the chancellor. But then afterwards, also last year, Facebook shut down our page completely, took down years of archives, of online classes, of syllabi, of material, of everything else. They are not explaining why they have done
that. Let's bring in Charlotte Cates on the discussion as well, Ms. Cates. Similar calls were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said that Facebook had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues speaking about human rights violations carried out by Israelis. So the claim is not just coming from Palestinian sources. Why is this happening, in your opinion? Why is information pointing out Israeli human rights violations and crimes? Are they being suppressed and concealed?
Well, when we look at the role of these big tech companies, so we've got Facebook, Twitter, Zoom, these kinds of big tech companies, they are engaged in shaping a narrative that works hand in hand with U.S. imperialism. These are some of the largest corporations that are currently based in the United States. And so we're seeing that being weaponized against Palestinian discourse, the censorship of words like martyrs, the censorship of the names of Palestinian political parties and organizations, in order to serve the interests, frankly, of U.S. imperialism and its alliance with the Israeli occupation. We see the same thing taking place in which content from countries targeted by sanctions and U.S. imperialism is labeled as state-sponsored content, while the same kind of content from official sources, for example, from the BBC or a German-sponsored media agency, are not labeled as state-sponsored content. And so this is an attack by big tech to control the access of to information that people have around the world because of the fact that Palestinians have been so successful in breaking the silence imposed upon the Palestinian cause by mainstream media and corporate media and imperialist states through their creative and active use of social media, technology, and various methods of communication.
Sure. Ms. Abdelhadi, an account of a Palestinian journalist was restricted twice this year, once just in December when videos depicting Israeli attacks on Palestinians were posted. In both cases, Facebook said it intervened because the posts violated the platform's standards. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, said that its policies were designed to give everyone a voice while keeping them safe on our apps, also adding, quote, "We apply these policies to everyone equally, regardless of who is posting." Is that the case?
Actually, that's definitely not the case. And there is so many flaws in this argument. One is that when they say they are applying equally, who is applying equally? And who's really setting the standards? And according to whom? And who's participating in it? We know there are high officials in Facebook who are actually setting it thus in consultation with various governments. They have done it again and again and again. So it's actually the whole question of equal is really not true, and it's inaccurate labeling to say to start with. Secondly, the whole question of how they are setting up is also a question. Third is that why is it that Facebook is also shutting down, as my colleague Charlotte Case said, shutting down posts also from, for example, on Kashmir liberation. They're shutting down posts on any other liberation around the world and actually allowing a lot of weaponizing of hate speech, of violence, of incitement to be there and succumbing to the pressures from various Israeli groups and various hate groups, various racist groups and so on. And it has to do with the fact that we're dealing with the Silicon Valley and we're dealing with Facebook as well as Zoom and other platforms which are very much profit related, and they are only concerned with their alliances and they're not really concerned with the truth and justice. They are only concerned with actually adding more ads and getting more people to subscribe. And so they believe that if they are suppressing Palestine, that might actually work. The problem with that is that it will always backfire because there is more and more people supporting Palestine. There is more and more people recognizing what's going on. Major human rights violation, major human rights organizations have already documented and stated what has happened. Major electronic groups such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others have also documented what has been going on. So Facebook is actually really stuck now having to explain what is going on. So they're backpedaling to cover up the wrong that they are doing by aligning themselves with Israel and its racist and colonialist policies,
right,
and by suppressing Palestinian voices.
Right. Charlotte Cates, do you recall the issue, I think it was from earlier this year, when young teenage girls were being targeted by sexual predators on Facebook? We spoke to a staff member right here on our channel from the company who alluded to lax protocols for monitoring content on Facebook. So let's hit pause there and come back to the issue that we're talking about right now regarding Palestinian posts. A Meta spokesperson said that it has a, quote, dedicated team which includes Arabic and Hebrew speakers who are focused on keeping our community safe by making sure we're removing harmful content. So which is it? They have a team of watchful eyes for pro-Palestinian content, but the pedophiles aren't as harmful?
Well, it's sad. If we look at May of this year, May of 2021, during the Unity Uprising throughout occupied Palestine, Facebook was seemingly a very safe place for hateful content by Zionist extremists encouraging violence in occupied Palestine 48 and participating in the ongoing riots targeting Palestinians in Palestine 48, assistance of the Israeli occupation army. And we've seen that systematically in hateful, racist, openly, blatantly racist content in the sources is deemed to be acceptable, while merely listing the name of a Palestinian political party like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, or the Popular Front for in a news article makes that same information dangerous by Facebook. And so what we see is that these big tech companies bring out the narrative of the Israeli occupation and of U.S. imperialism Palestinian content. So it's also quite a safe space for forms of racist hatred, white supremacy, Zionist for Palestinian content and for internationalist content. Imperialism. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians by Zionists. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians living under the bombs in Gaza, in exile around the world, or in being targeted by the guns of the occupier in the West Bank and Jerusalem or Palestine 48. Palestinian safety is considered to be something that is not the responsibility of Facebook, just like the Israeli. Mutual approach that's taken with the Israeli occupation in the same way we've seen, you know, time and time again that there are actually thousands and tens of thousands of reports filed by the Israeli occupation regime with Facebook on a regular basis. And we saw in 2015 during the Al-Quds uprising that was taking place that Israeli occupation essentially put strong pressure on Facebook and threatened to ban it within the country. And while Facebook was already a big tech company kind of serving U.S. interests, after 2015, we saw a dramatic escalation in the number of Palestinian posts being taken down and targeted because of this ongoing coordination that was established between Facebook and the Israeli occupation state.
Okay, Ms. Abdulhadi, according to Palestinian Social Media Monitoring Center, Sada Social, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021. We said that's a record for the year. So the Palestinians, basically, they face an asymmetrical battle both on the ground and also in the media. What alternatives does that leave for the Palestinians? I think that's where many observers and commentators come in and say that resistance is the only alternative for Palestinians at this point.
Yes, of course. Palestinians, I should just say that, have been resisting for over 100 years the Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. The resistance is not new. It continues and it keeps escalating and it keeps including more and more people. And every single time Israel succeeds in crushing a major defeat by conducting massacres, by killing hundreds of people and so on, that has happened multiple times around Gaza. That is happening sometimes silently, not even reported in the media, in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, in the Old City, in Lid, in Akka, in Haifa, in Bir Sabah, in Naqab. This is happening all the time. And I think biggest part of the problem for Israel and its supporters, including Facebook, is that they have been unable to crush Palestinian resistance. They have been unable to say that this is a land without people for a people without a land. They failed. Israel has failed. Zionism has failed to do so. So they are escalating their aggression and their attempt to silencing and crush using the money accounts that they have with the pressures of the Facebook and Silicon Valley and so on. They're using the pressures with the Israeli Ministry of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. For example, there is this app called ACT-IL that sent 19,000 messages to Zoom to shut down an open classroom that my colleague Tomomi Kanekawa and I were organizing last year with the Palestinian feminist icon Leila Khaled. They continue doing this again and again. Sada Social is totally 100% correct in what is going on. So this means that, of course, Palestinians will continue resisting. They have no choice but to resist. A people that is suppressed is always going to yearn to be free. It will resist. It will continue to resist by every single aspect available to them, including the many Palestinian social media activists who are raising the voices high and making it known to us that there is censorship that is going on. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. People who are not inside Palestine and so on would not know what's going on. And the fact that the world is responding, the world is condemning what Israel is doing. We would like the world to be a little bit faster in that, so less Palestinian lives and less lives all around are being lost. But the Palestinians have no choice. They have to resist, and they will continue on resisting until all Palestine is free.
Right. Charlotte, Kate, one angle of all of this is trying to align anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, if you criticize Israel, then you're being an anti-Semite. But we know that many Jews, even Israeli Jews, that criticize Israel for its rights violations and crimes. Is this just another way of trying to control the narrative, in your opinion?
This is another example of the attempt to turn reality on its head. The reality is that the Palestinian Liberation Movement is an anti-fascist, anti-colonial movement that is on the side of all people who are fighting against racism, oppression, and discrimination and all. On the other hand, the Zionist movement is fundamentally a fascist that is based on racism, colonialism, and so by invoking the concept of when really Zionism is itself an anti-Semitic thing. The concept of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish prejudice, the leaders of Israeli war crimes and Israeli apartheid are attempting to change the discourse to focus instead on the idea that Palestinian colonialism and fighting back to defend their rights are somehow the oppressors in the nation. It's an attempt to turn reality on its head. In reality, if we want to, anti-Jewish oppression, anti-Semitism, just like all forms of racism, this means standing hand in hand with the Palestinian liberation struggle, not hand in hand with the Zionist movement, which has increasingly built its ties with every far right and fascist regime around the world, regardless of their position on the crimes of the Nazis, regardless of their position on fascism. That's who the Israeli state is aligned with, okay. Is the far right, is the fascist forces.
Well, let's get a final thought in from Ms. Abdul Hadi. I'd like to get your thoughts on the same issue. Is all of this happening to control the narrative, making the previous statement that we just mentioned some kind of default, that if you're anti-Israeli, then you're an anti-Semite and you must be shunned and banned and silenced?
Yes. I will just say three points about this in addition to what we've already heard from your guest, Charlotte Hayes. One is that, yes, they are trying to control the narrative. The Palestinian narrative is a narrative of resistance, of resilience, of steadfastness. Zionism is trying to impose a narrative of submission, subjugation, and defeat. And they are, of course, trying to do that. This is failing. This is something that actually is going on. That's one thing that's really, really important. Secondly, what does this really mean? It means that for all of us not to be silent, for all of us to say we will not be silenced, we're actually going to escalate and raise every single voice of Palestine high and amplify the Palestinian demands to be able to speak, to be able to express, to be able to reflect the reality on the ground to the outside world. The final point I would say is that there is so many more support for Palestine all over. Zionism claiming that that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism is failing also among multiple and broader ranks of Jews, not to mention other people around the world who are seeking justice. At the end of the day, Zionism has really failed, but that's why also bullies become bullier, become more vicious when they are whenever they are
sure.
failing. The only solution is for us to continue resisting, raising our voices, speaking up, and saying we will not be silenced.
Indeed, and that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, founding director at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdul Hadi, joining us from San Francisco, and also thanks to Ms. Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver. And thanks to you for staying with us on It's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah.